The Gogreen survey has been going on for 5 years. We've used, I think, pretty much every large optical telescope on the planet, a team of about 40 people involved. And finally, we have the first results. And so this will be the first presentation where we get to show actual results. Okay, so here's the team, a reasonably large team. The team in the green box are those that have been most active over the recent years. And I want to highlight the work of the people down below, my grad students, Christy Webb, Karen McNabb, and Andrew Reeves. Two of them are here, and postdoc Remco Vanderberg. I'll be showing mostly results from Christy and Remco's work today. Okay, so just as a brief introduction, the story of galaxy evolution, which is all this messy astrophysics that we heard about earlier today, we don't like to talk about in polite company. Well, that's all I do, is the messy astrophysics. So galaxy evolution, the story of this can be encapsulated in a couple of plots. So the one on the left here is the cosmic star formation rate, total star formation rate per unit volume in the universe versus redshift, sort of a terrible axis choice. Neither the redshift or the time axis is linear. But that's okay. So over the past 10 billion years of time in the universe, the star formation rate has been declining quite strongly by about a factor of 20 or so. And the history of star formation in the universe is there was a ramp up over the first few billion years and then declined after that. So galaxies at so-called cosmic noon, at the peak of the star formation density of the universe, they look quite different from those today. They're clumpier, they're gas rich, they have very high star formation rates, and they're quite fundamentally different from the sort of grand design spiral galaxies we see that dominate the star formation density today. So part of that decline in star formation over the past 10 billion years is driven by this sort of transformation of star forming galaxies just gradually getting tired. Okay, and so this shows the star formation history of a single galaxy, or a single, you know, galaxies of a given halo mass or stellar mass that has itself declined by more than an order of magnitude over the past 10 billion years. And so that's part of the story. But that's not the only thing going on. So if we look at the stellar mass function of star-forming galaxies, which is what we have there on the left, so the log of the number of galaxies is a function of the log of their mass. Okay, so there's a lot more low-mass galaxies than there are high-mass galaxies. And if we look at how that stellar mass function evolves with time, that's what the darker and darker curves are that mass function at higher redshifts, they actually lie on top of each other to a large degree. They don't evolve. And that's kind of puzzling in a sense, because these are star-forming galaxies, so as they are making stars, they should be moving to the right. And the fact that that's not happening tells you things have to be dropping off that sequence altogether. And indeed, we see them build up in the population of dead galaxies or quiescent galaxies that aren't forming stars at all. And that population has increased dramatically over the last 10 billion years. And so that's more or less what's happening. We know quite a bit about how that quenching process occurs. Okay, and it's driven by a feedback process, is almost certainly in most cases. At the high stellar mass end, we're dominated by things like AGN feedback, supermassive black holes in the centers of these galaxies accrete, emit an enormous amount of energy, and turn off star formation. At the lower stellar mass end, stellar winds, supernova feedback, and things like that are likely responsible for most of the quenching. Okay, so we understand all that stuff. The star formation history of a galaxy, though, doesn't depend only on its halo mass or its stellar mass. It also has some dependence on the large-scale structure around it. Okay, so for example, if we look at a massive cluster of galaxies nearby us today, we see that the fraction of quenched galaxies, those that aren't forming stars anymore, is much higher at all stellar masses than those that aren't in clusters. So somehow galaxies know that they're in a big cluster or a small cluster, even though they have the same stellar mass. Their local environment is very similar. So one way we characterize that is this curve here. The fraction of dead galaxies is a function of their stellar mass. The kind of stuff we saw in the previous plot has this fraction, the orange triangles, going from 0 to 1. Okay, and then if we look at the same things in clusters of galaxies, you get the green squares. And for a given stellar mass, there are more quenched galaxies. And so the question is, what is the role of the environment? Where does that extra quenching come from?
So you use, three different terms you use, dead galaxies, quenched galaxies, and quiescent galaxies, they mean the same.
They all mean exactly the same thing, right? I'm just trying to hope that I'll connect with one of you for one of these things. That's right, okay. Yes, so they all mean exactly the same thing. there's a long story here, but there's two key observations of this at a low redshift that I want to highlight because we're going to come back to them. First of all, is that the quenching due to environment and the quenching that's due to the mass of the galaxy seem to be entirely separable. Okay, and the way we phrase that, this plot here on the left, what we call environmental quenching efficiency, sort of says how much extra quenching is going on in a dense environment. And it's about 30 or 40%. That means 30 or 40% of galaxies that are accreted onto a cluster have their star formation turned off prematurely, let's say. And that's independent of stellar mass. The second thing is that if we look at the stellar mass function of those quenched, dead, quiescent galaxies, okay, that stellar mass function depends very much on their environment.
So was that previous statement, you know, controversial or not? Because I've heard other people say, different things about that.
Interesting. Over this stellar mass range, I don't think it's terribly controversial.
Andrew Heron and Doug Watson, for example, they have these models where they totally ignore the environment. They just say that, you see, like galaxies have some clock, an internal clock that turns themselves off after they form after some time, and they've been, the claim is that that simple model can reproduce basically any two-point statistic for galaxies.
That's true. So that's another way of interpreting the same data. So the statement I made is not controversial. This is an observational quantity. Okay, there's no actual.
Yeah, but the statement that the environment and the internal property is separable.
So I mean that purely in a measurement sense, okay? So if we measure how the fraction of dead galaxies depends on mass, and then I take out that correlation, and I look at how it depends on environment, I get this flat curve. Now, there are ways that you can end up with that flat curve in a more complicated model that doesn't have those two things independent, but the fact that that is flat at least admits a simple model where you have one thing going on in environments, one thing happening on halo mass scales.
So if this antenna clock is just the function of environment, then basically the high density is of a galaxy from earlier.
Right.
Yeah, so that's the way that these trends arise in that model.
That's right. So we'll come back to that at the end, okay? I'm gonna show that that doesn't look like that's what's going on, but we need other data to show that.
Right.
Okay. So we look at the stellar mass function and we see that there's a change in the stellar mass function as you go into denser environments. And one simple way of explaining all this, or at least a way of creating that effect from the observations, is to have accreted star-forming galaxies, which have a very different stellar mass function. You quench them independent of their mass in dense environments, and that leads to this increased tail at low masses and the mass-independent quenching efficiency. Okay. So that's a reasonably popular interpretation of what's going on at low redshifts. So why is this interesting? Well, one question is just what causes this environmental part? Is there even an environmental part, or is it something else going on that's a third parameter? There's no shortage of ideas, okay, in terms of actual physical effects, in terms of third parameter type models that might explain the same thing. But almost all theoretical models, hydrodynamic models or semi-analytic models, get this wrong, okay, and often by a lot. So the green here is what we're looking at, that's the quench fraction in clusters, and the green line is a prediction from a few years ago. And they get them wrong, interestingly, that they always overpredict the amount of quenching. So you put in all these things that should be going on, and they just quench everything within clusters. Okay. It's been a really hard problem to solve. Maybe it's a detail, okay, and who cares? Or maybe it's really telling us that we don't understand something fundamental about how feedback and star formation are working on in galaxies.
That's in 2D or in 3D? Sorry.
Is what in 2D?
Like the y-axis. Do you have to worry about projection effects, I guess?
Oh, yes. But in this case, where we're doing this model comparison to the data, the model is including the projection, the expected projection effect. Okay,
so there's no projection in the model because it's zero. Okay.
Yeah. So in this case, that's a semi-analytic model that I'm plotting there, and what they do is they try to reproduce the type of observations you would make for a cluster. How many field galaxies would you have along the line of sight, and include those, and then you can. think about how well you know that and what the uncertainties are. This has been pretty consistent. Actually, these models are doing reasonably well for a long time. The models were all up here as a straight line at one. They just quench everything. It doesn't matter what you do, and that's clearly inconsistent. So Gull-Green, what's this about? So one way to get some more information about what's happening is to look at higher redshift. If we look at cosmic noon, where all the star formation was going on, galaxies are totally different, okay? They're just, their feedback rates are different, their star formation rates are different, their gas masses are different, okay? But we still have massive galaxy clusters, and all the stuff is nonlinear, so we should be able, by looking at what happens at high redshift, get some handle on how all these things play together. So Gull-Green is a sample of 21 systems that span a pretty wide range in halo mass, okay, so that's the y-axis, factor of 20 or 30 in halo mass, at a look-back time, well, between redshift 1 and 1.5, close to the peak of star formation rate. Basically, as high as we can go from the ground, as high redshift as we can go from the ground and do this work. Okay, and so the idea is, you know, let's push it as far as we can go. So for each of these clusters, we have quite a lot of spectroscopy from Gemini up to 15 hours per galaxy. And we have deep multi-wavelength photometry from the ultraviolet out to the near infrared. And so we have quite nice spectra for a large fraction of the galaxies and full SEDs for everything. Okay, so a huge amount of work to get all that data together. The data release, the public data release is this summer. And first science papers are all being written now. Here's a bunch of them, but I'm going to talk about some of the first results right now. Okay, so three surprises from the initial look at the data. Okay, and this was really a project where everything had to come together, had to have all the data in place and homogenized and analyzed together before we start looking at results, because it's all very subtle. So the first thing, we just measure this quenching rate, okay, the excess quenching in clusters relative to the field. Same plot I had before, where for low redshift, this was a flat line at about 35%. Now we look at these clusters of redshift 1.5. The quenching efficiency is higher. And not too many people would have actually predicted that a number of years ago. Okay, it's a little bit counterintuitive. And it's not only higher, but it's pretty clearly stellar mass dependent. Okay, so what it, at least this thing that we're measuring, this extra amount of quenched galaxies that are in clusters, is quite different from what we see at low redshift. Okay, so this picture that you can't really see is showing one of our clusters, and what you can't see is that there's a whole bunch of these small red galaxies. Actually, the cluster looks very much like a redshift zero coma cluster. It's full of red elliptical looking like galaxies at redshift 1.5. It's not quite obvious that.
So you're looking at both clusters and fewer galaxies here?
Yes. That's right, because we get spectra for everything along the line of sight. Of course, we don't know whether it's in the cluster of the field, and also a reasonably wide radial range. And so we get a field sample that's selected exactly the same way as the cluster sample. Okay, the second surprise, the one that was really a big surprise, we look at the stellar mass function of those cluster galaxies, the quenched galaxies, the dead galaxies. That's the red points. And we compare that to the field at the same redshift, and they're identical. Okay. Compare that to what we see at low redshift, where there's a very big difference in the faint end of the stellar mass functions, depending on environment. Here at high redshift, they're identical. So somehow, there's even more quenching going on, or more, let's just call it that, just more quenching going on in the clusters. But unlike at low redshift, it's operating on stellar masses exactly the same way as it is for the surrounding field. That was a big surprise. And one thing that makes us think is along the lines of what you were saying, well, maybe that just means that these clusters have some primordial population of things that quenched very early on. They kind of got a head start. And it's the same process as happens in the field, but it just happened earlier.
Sorry, back to surprising number one. Why was it surprising that there's more quenching at higher redshifts? Isn't there more AGN activity at higher redshifts as well?
So yes, but there's also, you know, the stellar, the gas content is higher, the accretion rate is higher, the star formation rates are higher. I mean, you're right. So you can, it's not super hard to come up with an explanation afterwards, right? So you say that, yes, so the AGN, the feedback efficiency is so much stronger at high redshift that that actually depletes your gas on a shorter time scale than it does at low redshift. But it wasn't obvious a priori that those two would balance that way.
But is the picture that these satellites are being quenched by some central AGN in the cluster, or instead that they're being quenched due to some sort of like flying through hot gas in the cluster?
Oh, this environmental quenching almost certainly is not due to the AGN in the center of the cluster, at least not directly.
Right.
Okay, but I mean, they, at least the biggest ones will have AGN in themselves, right? And so if there's something that enhances that, for example, in clusters or gets a head start.
So what kind of feedback that would produce this mass dependence of quenching?
Oh, well, this isn't so different from what we see in the field, okay? The fact that is this, we have this mass dependence in the clusters, okay, this is showing this excess quenching. What that is really saying is that the stellar mass function looks exactly the same as the stellar mass function of quenched galaxies in the field, okay, but the proportion is higher in clusters, okay, and so that gives you this mass dependence of the excess quenching rate. Okay, so they're really telling the same story, which is that the rate at which you're building up this stellar mass function and probably the way you're doing that is exactly the same in the two environments. Just for some reason, you've done it a lot more in the clusters. So surprise number three, and this is really nice work that Christy Webb, my PhD student, has been doing. And she talked a little bit about this at the inauguration of WCA last year. So we have spectra for all these galaxies. We also have photometry over quite a wide wavelength range. And so she's fitting multi-parameter models, templates, to both simultaneously with an MCMC code to quite robustly measure things like the ages, the metallicities, the star formation histories, and here just focusing on the quenched galaxies, okay, because they're the easiest ones to model in a sense. This here is the bottom line. So here we're plotting the ages of those galaxies in the sense of this is their formation time since the Big Bang as a function of their stellar mass. Okay, we've got the field on the top, cluster on the bottom, and I've just drawn a horizontal line at 1 billion years for reference. And the surprising thing is that the field and cluster galaxies, basically the oldest galaxies in both environments, are exactly the same age. Okay, so one way that we could have explained the previous two surprises is to just have the cluster get a head start. For some reason, have the clock start a little bit earlier, but then you'd expect them to be 500 million or even 1 billion years older is what you need to explain those observations. They're not. They're basically identical. And so the upshot of all that is actually that none of our simple ideas for explaining these environmental trends really work to explain all of these three things. And we have a couple of other works. I mean, Andrew in particular is working on a nice paper showing how all this depends on halo mass, which further is puzzling in the sense that we're not seeing quite what we expect there. So nothing that we thought might work is really quite working, which is exactly where we want to be at this stage, okay? So now we've got to think about what that means. The takeaway point is that these redshift one clusters, okay, all these little red dots here, you can see if you could just blow them up, if you could see them in the same resolutions we see today, looks basically the same as the Coma cluster today. And that's surprising to me. They seem to have had some enhanced early form of quenching, which looks very much like what we call the mass quenching, the stuff that happens in normal field galaxies. At least its imprint on the stellar mass function is identical. And it's not likely just a head start, because they're not older. So one possibility is that ultimately everything is tied to gas exhaustion, okay, star formation rate and the AGN feedback and expulsion of gas at high redshifts that leads to quenching in normal galaxies, massive galaxies, is also happening in clusters, but just at an enhanced rate. One way that might happen is if star formation is enhanced in dense environments, for example. So maybe it's merger induced, and maybe this is all happening in protoclusters. Mergers and interactions or other things are causing the star formation rates to be higher by a significant factor. They use up their gas more quickly, and that's the accelerated clock. It's not that they started earlier, but that they lived fast and died young. But it's not clear that actually works with everything. And everything else that we talk about, ram pressure stripping and other dynamical effects related to the orbits around the clusters, must be things that happen later than redshift one. From the ages that Christie finds, okay, that everything formed about 1 billion years after the Big Bang, all this quenching, all this population that has appeared in these big clusters must have formed basically a redshift 5.5. So presumably looking in protoclusters of that redshift, we see all these massive galaxies. Sorry, it's not just massive galaxies. There's things down at 10 to the 9.5 that are being quenched through this mechanism. And that must have all happened really soon after the Big Bang. And we really have to wait for JWST, hopefully launching soon, to have a good look at what the universe looks like at that time. Okay, so that's, don't need them.
Perfect.
Okay, good. Done, thanks.